welcome to this, the third of the Wednesday lecture series, Whatever Happened to Politics. But before I say anything about Gerry, I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land in which this event is taking place, the land of the Wurundjeri, and pay respect for their elders and families. Gerry's you can see the title is Political Literacy. I've known Gerry for a few years now, and I'm still astonished by the depth and fineness of his intelligence. In fact, he's the kind of person one is constantly tempted to ask, is there anything you haven't read? So, he's never showy about the fact, and never invites the question, obviously. It's been indeed a great privilege for me to have come to the law school and to have Gerry as a colleague and also now as a friend. Gerry is the Professor of International Law here and a visiting Professor of Public International Law at the London School of Economics, where he held a chair until 2009. He taught at the University of British Columbia, the London School of Economics, and the Australian National University, and has held visiting positions at the Sydney Law School and Harvard Law School. He's the author of Great Powers and Outlaw States, and Law, War and Crime, War Crimes Trials, and the Reinvention of International Law. His next book is a collection of essays entitled The Margins of International Law, together with me, we're editing Who's Afraid of International Law. Welcome, Gerry.
Thank you very much, Ray, for that over-generous introduction. And thank you to everyone who organized this lecture. I know it takes a very great effort on the part of the professional staff to put together these lectures, and thank you all for coming in this era of high winds and earthquakes. So at the end of last week's Wednesday lecture, Ray made an observation about the word reconciliation and the way in which embedded in this word is the odd suggestion that Australia's Indigenous peoples need to make reparation or apology to its non-Indigenous majority, or that somehow reconciliation works both ways in equal amounts. We might choose to extract two lessons of political literacy from this. One is that languages matter. They're not just communication devices through which we make claims for resources or appeal to constituencies of voters. Particular words and phrases carry hidden charges and eliminate certain ways of thinking. For example, reconciliation smuggles quite a few other assumptions into its bland luggage. It might imply that the two parties to reconciliation are somehow close to equal. It might give the impression that the messy world of politics has been left behind, and that what is needed is a symbolic coming together of these two parties. It might have a tendency to depict the anger of one party or the other to be out of bounds or gauche. It might encourage the thought that the material circumstances of both parties are more or less equivalent, and that they now need to shake hands and move on. In a different context, a term like peace process is suggestive in a similar way. The other lesson is that history matters to political literacy. To think politically is to think historically. And since the past is in some ways a history of injury, not thinking about the past or not thinking historically is both politically illiterate and pernicious. Again, the word reconciliation, for example, might screen out a history of violence or disadvantage. I don't know, it may not. But from what I heard last week, this is certainly a possibility. We know in Australia that there's been a long-running history war about the particular story of conquest or settlement, another word that has, in some respects, constituted the invasion of Australia as largely peaceful. This black armband debate was not so much about whether events had taken place, but about whether to dwell on them or teach them or attempt an understanding of them. I reread Animal Farm recently with my daughter, who's here tonight. And the most moving passages for me came in those famous scenes where the animals just couldn't remember all the original slogans and rules and principles of the revolution before it was hijacked by Napoleon and the pigs. Sometimes the illiteracy of the animals allowed history to be literally rewritten, some histories, of course, being more equal than others. So maybe after these very tentative opening remarks, I can offer a working definition of political literacy as having something to do with, in thinking about political life, a combined attentiveness to language and history. At least that will have to do to begin with. Now, why might political literacy be so difficult? Well, it could have something to do with our current circumstances. We live in paradoxical times in a paradoxical country. High levels of pessimism combined with unprecedented levels of wealth and material well-being. Never before experienced educational opportunity translates into a powerful belief in the decline of public and political discourse. A frenetic effort to reach out or to convince the demos has left people more disillusioned than ever by the language of politics. In a world of spin, all we are left with is a heap of broken images. Our system of government is one of the most sophisticated and mature ever seen, yet it is widely ridiculed and often by politicians themselves. There is, in some respects, more official inquiry into the nature of governance than ever before. Think of Finkelstein and Leveson on the role of the media. Yet, to the electorate, ruleship seems obscure and cliquey. We are perpetually at war in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. Yet most of us do not experience the effects of war. Most of us, indeed, have not been asked as a contribution to these wars to make any sacrifices at all. We are safer from proximate threats of political violence than just about any generation in any place in history. Yet we feel deeply insecure. We have, since 1945, experienced a period of astonishing political stability and economic growth, yet we feel haunted by the portents of coming crises. Any discussion of political literacy or dignity has to, I think, reckon with this, and in particular with three disorders or catastrophes in the making. These catastrophes then press upon us and our politics, and they might offer some sort of answer to the general question of the lecture series, whatever happened to politics. So let me sketch these three threats. First, we face the immediate but always just deferred threat of economic collapse. This acute instability is, I think, new. I grew up in a crisis-haunted Britain. There were strikes, power cuts, OPEC oil shortages. Britain even went to the IMF for a loan. This was the sort of thing that happened only to Nigeria or Thailand. Yet I don't remember anyone suggesting the whole monetary or fiscal system was on the point of implosion. Am I imagining it? Or does the former Bank of England governor, Mervyn King, warn us roughly every 9 months or so that this crisis is the worst since the Great Depression? Gordon Brown said in the House of Commons a couple of years ago that he had saved the world. He had meant to say the banking system and was held down by the parliamentary mob. But there was something very symptomatic about this episode. We do understand the world to be so vulnerable that Gordon Brown could save it. And we have a sense that in some quarters, the banking system or the financial system is indeed the only world that really counts. Today, there's a dreamlike quality to the way in which we are told that the system of global capitalism is one transaction away from meltdown, while at the same time being told that there's no alternative to it and that it is the only way to ensure material well-being and stability. Meanwhile, we get richer and richer and our wealth seems more and more fragile. Second, our lives and politics, and this is not so new, are haunted by another specter. It says something for our circumstances that so little time is spent discussing the most immediate of existential threats humanity has ever faced. There are said to be 26,000 nuclear warheads in the world, down from a high of 32,000 in 1966, but it would take a sunny disposition to think of this as good news. Over a third of them are controlled by the very authoritarian Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Another half or so are American missiles. Perhaps we have less to worry about in relation to the missiles of allies. On the other hand, last year, Rick Perry, at the time a credible candidate for the Republican Party nomination, proposed abolishing the Department of Energy, the department with oversight responsibilities for the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Other missiles are dotted around Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. But the threat of nuclear war is discussed only in the context of a state that might not yet have nuclear weapons, Iran. On that subject, Rick Santorum said during the Republican Party debates, which I happen to have been watching, and to the sort of Pavlovian applause that I used to associate with the Stalinist show trials, that he hoped the United States was playing some role in ensuring that dead scientists were turning up in Iran. And when it comes to reducing the U.S.'s own arsenal, something it ought to be doing under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we have to take Dick Cheney's word for it. He famously admitted that he had never met a weapon system he didn't vote for. Is it entirely implausible to suggest then that the existence of nuclear weapons might have an effect on political literacy, on a belief in politics at all? War is, of course, the continuation of politics by other means, but nuclear war is likely to represent the discontinuation of man's interest in politics altogether. And the threat of nuclear annihilation might have an annihilating or at least compromising effect on our politics. As one English writer famously put it, in the shadow of nuclear war, we are Einstein's monsters, not fully human, not for now. Finally, as if this isn't enough, we have the problem of greenhouse gas emissions and rising global temperatures. Like the prospect of fiscal and nuclear doom, this encourages a particular response in the electorate and amongst large sectors of the political class. They would rather not think about it. And we haven't been thinking about it much since as long ago as 1979, when the Carter-era National Academy of Sciences issued a report stating that the climate was changing and that these changes would not be negligible. Each successive report by the Intergovernmental Panel, meanwhile, brings more bad news, though the news is very bad for our grandchildren and not so bad for us. Now, political illiteracy here translates into denialism, but we might think of climate denialism as provoking two responses or coming in two types: those that deny the validity of the scientific evidence and those that are in denial about evidence they regard as compelling. In some respects, and I know Rob will talk about this next week, those that deny there is a problem are unlikely to be as dangerous as those who know there's a problem but refuse to or simply can't find a way to confront it. I think that's most of us. The former is an effect of our impoverished politics. In the United States, outright denial is, of course, potent, probably because the political system is so thoroughly carbonized. The latter form of denial, though, is producing an effect on our politics, a sense that the grand strategy is now out of bounds or impossible or deviant or subject to fatal collective action problems. And so these are our three traumas. Sorry to begin in such a depressive mood. If I had to choose a word to describe the way in which the political class has chosen to act in relation to them, I would use a very loaded term from the 1930s, appeasement. Politics has become the art of hoping it won't happen. But in the case of fiscal collapse, it seems very likely that it will. It already has in Greece and Mexico and Thailand and Argentina. In the case of nuclear weapons, we always seem to be one accident away, or perhaps one depression away, from calamity. In the case of global warming, we seem to be toying with a band between 2 to 5 degrees of an increase in temperature, hoping that we stay in the lower range and lose only Bangladesh, a few Pacific islands, and perhaps the low-lying parts of London. I think in a way each of these pressures has a profoundly depoliticizing effect. Politics seems small around global warming, incidental to nuclear war and marginal to economic vertigo. The truly decisive questions now appear as a matter of fate, leaving only the ephemera and the procedural to politics. It might be, too, that because of this, politicians and citizens alike are somehow disabled from taking the long view. I have no doubt that the concentration of media ownership, the structure of political process, and the trivializing effects of changing technologies all play a part, but bigger existential issues are also in play. So that our material conditions might be degrading our appetite for the sort of attentiveness I spoke of earlier. So I now want to turn to political illiteracy. Or perhaps a better way to put this is to think of these as other possible versions of political literacy that fall short of the strong-ish conception I have sketched here. Let's gather them all up under the heading weak political literacy or faux literacy. And I want to begin by saying a little about politicians themselves, and then something about the rest of us, and in particular about a class that used to be called the intelligentsia. So, weak political literacy. One form of weak political literacy might be thought of as a kind of facility around the system, an ease with soundbite politics, a chumminess around one's political friends and enemies. Tony Abbott and Julia Gillard are clearly literate in this way. Gillard, in particular, has devoted her life to politics, and watching her on, say, Q&A is an education in a certain sort of consummate and not at all easily acquired political literacy. I can give this speech, but I couldn't do what she does on Q&A. I don't underestimate this sort of intelligence. To put this in some sort of comparative perspective, the gulf between, say, Herman Cain and Tony Abbott is unbridgeably huge. But this form of political literacy requires one not to go too deep on the three crises I have mentioned. Indeed, it now seems to be agreed amongst the political class that these three crises are to be treated as somehow beyond or outside politics, with the very partial exception, say, of the carbon price. And certainly I get no sense of urgency about these matters from the political class, certainly not compared to, say, the Kevin Thompson credit card affair or the threat posed by a handful of the world's most disadvantaged human beings as they huddle together on small boats in an effort to reach Australia. So politics has somehow become a matter of mastering the pre-political, the instincts, vanities, anger, and distress of the electorate, and the post-political, the comfort, economic growth, and identity of the nation, but has less to do with the stuff of politics, justice, redistribution, ideology, the sense that there might be choices to be made about the general direction a society might take, and so on. So we have a certain kind of political operator who can respond brilliantly to and maneuver freely amidst the instincts of a significant portion of the voting class. A substantial minority is usually enough. And who regards questions of justice and ideology as either matters for the technocracy in the case of justice or irredeemably old hat in the case of ideological contestation. When I was 19, I attended a jurisprudence tutorial every Wednesday morning. There were about 8 students in this class. There was a radical vegetarian, a landowning young Tory, a proto-Thatcherite, a punk rocker, a rabid Scottish nationalist, and a totally uncompromising socialist who dressed in nothing but black. And I'm not kidding when I say he later stood for Parliament as a Conservative. This was probably the most thrilling and bruising seminar I have ever attended. Almost every one of my classmates had very powerful and strong political beliefs. I say almost everyone. One of them, someone I liked a great deal, was very high up in student politics, but didn't seem to have particularly strong political views. His position on most questions resolved itself into an intensely pragmatic but slightly slippery solution to a problem the rest of us hadn't quite identified. He became a very senior political figure. In whose government, you might ask? A facetious answer might be anyone's. He was a one-man coalition. In fact, he was a Labour cabinet member. This charming man, a person I still like, wasn't even what you would call a career politician. He has spent his life switching effortlessly between the mercantile and public worlds. But when Ray spoke of the difference between politics as vocation and politics as career, I think it's partly this sort of figure to whom he was alluding. To digress for a second, there may be parallels in the legal world too. We are all familiar with the idea of law as a default university degree and profession, as opposed to law as a vocation. So some students, their passion for fine art or literature or design set aside as hobbies to be pursued later, but rarely pursued later, are eased into a law degree simply because of the accident of good marks and professional prestige. I don't suggest that these students don't make for able pupils or good lawyers, but they would never describe themselves as pursuing a vocation. Compare this sort of person with a friend of mine who read the Times law reports when she was in her early teens. So one can imagine, I think, encountering a young teenager who expresses an interest in becoming a lawyer. But it would be less common to speak to a 13-year-old about their desire to become a politician. I could be wrong about this, and like most of the lecture, it's based on instinct and a tiny amount of anecdotal research. But I suspect that many politicians didn't express their professional ambitions in this way. The vocational politician, I suspect, understood herself at 13 to be passionate either about a particular cause, anti-apartheid, the preservation of a river or lake, or about the possibility of widespread or global radical change. Entry into politics is a necessary byproduct, then, of the latter or a natural consequence of the former. For the vocational politician, being a politician is parasitic on the broader imperative. The career politician, I think, is not so much like this. I'll say something about him in a moment, but why make politics a career? There are so many reasons not to. Years ago, when I told my mother that my soon-to-be father-in-law had once been a doctor but was now a politician, she more or less said that she couldn't understand why a talented person would give up a good profession for a bad job. But my father-in-law, Moss Cass, who I hope would be here tonight but isn't, may be the opposite of a career politician. It's inconceivable, for example, that he could have chosen to move generically into politics in a way that my friend from law school did. Moss could not have been a member of any party except the Labour Party. No party came close until the advent of the Greens to reflecting his unbending political convictions about the redistribution of material wealth, about communal well-being, about curbing the deformities of excessive wealth, and so on. When that version of the Labour Party began to run out of steam, he left Parliament altogether. There was no career, only vocation. In Britain, Tony Benn, the bête noir of the conservative mainstream in the UK, used to say he had retired from Parliament in order to become involved in politics. So what about the career politician? Well, in 1983, just as Moss was retiring from the Australian Federal Parliament, a young English barrister was entering the House of Commons. During the election, an upcoming lawyer called Cherie Blair was the candidate for Margate in Kent. Her father, a well-known British soap star, knew Tony Benn, then the most powerful left-wing politician in the Labour Party, and had him come down to Margate from London to give a rousing speech to the party faithful. Cherie Blair sent her husband, Tony, to pick Benn up from his flat in Holland Park. Blair, Tony, thought Benn's speech was inspiring, and I quote, from Tony Blair. I sat enraptured and absolutely captivated. If only I could speak like that. The strange thing about the whole episode is that Blair didn't agree with anything that Benn had said. Form, as it were, had overtaken content in a way that was to prove emblematic. So let me indulge again my interest in Tony Blair, a person often associated, at least, with career politics. I thought I'd get a sense of why Blair went into politics from a rereading of his 700-page autobiography, A Journey. I went to the early pages where he describes his fascination with the political process, his commitment to the Labour Party, and his belief in the ideals of that party. But there was a problem. Those pages didn't exist. He does, it's true, describe joining the Labour Party, and I quote, after leaving Oxford, and I think the tense is very telling here, after leaving Oxford, I had joined the Labour Party. That's it. Following that sentence is a long three-page description of how stimulating Blair found working as a barrister. To take up again this point about depoliticization, the description of the Labour Party in these early pages suggests that Blair's only politics, in a way, is a dislike of politics. Whenever people disagree in the Labour Party, he describes it as, and I quote again, infighting, intrigue, and bitter recrimination. Labour Party activists are described as out of touch. Trade union politics are irretrievably old-fashioned. And standard Labour ideals are well-meaning but dangerous. At one point, I was relieved to hear a politician described as having character, leadership, and intelligence. But this is Margaret Thatcher. It quickly becomes clear that Blair doesn't really like people who are passionate about political life. It might be possible, if a little misleading, to describe the leadership of the Labour Party at this time as being split between career politics, Blair, and vocational politics, Brown. Brown, of course, was fatally under-equipped for the prime ministership because of his famous psychological flaws. Perhaps he believed in politics somehow. He was certainly steeped in it, which made his rightward shift seem more tragic or inevitable. But Blair had other priorities. What were they? An end to poverty, the promotion of just institutions, the abolition of privilege. Well, we heard one answer last week during the Leveson inquiry. At one point, Tony Blair is quoted as having said to Chris Mullen, a Labour MP, "My absolute priority is to win. I know it sounds unprincipled, but I believe it's my role in life." Robert Jay, the QC for the inquiry, asks Blair if he might have said that. "Yep, sounds like something I would have said," replies Blair to laughter in the press gallery. I doubt that this accurately reflects what Blair believes, but it's revealing that he might want us to think it. Let me offer a little digression here on democratic politics. It may be that we don't want politicians to be zealots, of course. Perhaps it's a sign of the health and maturity of political life that it decays or becomes careerist. Maybe this is a natural consequence of a move from charisma to rationality. This point should perhaps be pursued. It goes to two separate questions. One is the standard question about whether politics has always been like this. The other is whether it ought to be or naturally declines into careerism and technocracy. At the beginning of the lecture series, the Dean Carolyn Evans began by recounting some facts about political apathy and disillusionment, and these seem to be borne out in Laura Tingle's recent quarterly essay. Let me quote another writer bemoaning the state of contemporary democratic life. "There is no way out of this unless we have freedom of the intellect, which can only happen if the concept of right and wrong is restored to our politics." That seems an accurate comment on contemporary politics. Except George Orwell published this on the 9th of April, 1944, when it was included as part of an essay published in The Observer. This might lead us to the conclusion that politics is the realm of recurrence and repetition, with each generation obliged to reinvent a new cycle of apathy and disgruntlement. This might be the case. But it might possibly be the case, too, that this trend has intensified as democratic politics itself has become steadily degraded by the forces I've already identified. To put it in terms of political characters, is there a trajectory of decline from Roosevelt through Lyndon Johnson to George W. Bush, or from Whitlam and Fraser to Rudd and Howard, or from Churchill and Attlee to Blair and Cameron? Or is this all just nostalgia? I really don't know. Others will have firmer views. Another possibility, as I've said, is that democratic politics lends itself to a healthy disillusionment with its own institutions. The point of politics is to healthy democratic politics is to encourage precisely this sort of skeptical response. When we read a survey in which Australians express disappointment with the political system, we might compare this response not to a golden age of democratic engagement, but to periods when citizens were overzealously committed to politics. Political orders organized around fascism or forms of irredentist nationalism tend to be marked by high levels of enthusiasm and, of course, violence. This might be a good moment then to ask what levels of political literacy we might expect from electors, in other words, us, as opposed to politicians. In his opening lecture, Ray asked about our duties as citizens. What can we reasonably require and desire of our fellow citizens? Perhaps it's enough to be decent without requiring political sophistication as well. What would it mean to be an engaged citizen? In Martin Amis's eulogy for Christopher Hitchens, he recounted a story about going to a cinema on Long Island with Hitchens. At one point, the pair are strolling along the street. Amis turns to Hitchens, one of the best-known intellectuals, political intellectuals in America, and remarks on the fact that it has been 20 minutes since anyone has recognized Hitchens. "Oh, longer than that," replies Hitchens. This then prompts a tirade by Hitchens about the sorts of lives those people who don't recognize him might be leading. Lives without books, or journals, or Jim Lehrer's NewsHour, or Vanity Fair, presumably. The lives of political illiterates, we might be tempted to say. Obviously, such people exist. They may well be in the majority. A young woman in her 20s stayed at my house last year, and during the early stages of the parliamentary inquiry into the Murdochs and phone hacking, she turned to me at dinner and asked me if this Rupert Murdoch was a friend of mine. I replied, "No, what made you say that?" "Nothing," she said, "it's just that you talk about him all the time." It occurred to me that she didn't know who Rupert Murdoch was. And I think it's very important for me to say that this person was culturally very literate. She knew and understood film better than I did, and she was a talented musician and artist. So political illiteracy isn't just an incidence of a more general lack of knowledge or sophistication. It isn't stupidity. Yet knowing who Rupert Murdoch is must count as a qualification for engaging in certain sorts of conversations about political life, like sharing a language. We feel lost when our interlocutors don't share our maps of history. One of the most common tropes of academic life is the conversation between two aging lecturers, with one complaining to the other that her students didn't know who Winston Churchill was or hadn't realized there had been a Second World War. Perhaps we ought to expect more from our fellow citizens. Perhaps this is a failure related to schools or universities or the traditional media or the ubiquity of electronic devices or the various pre-traumas I spoke about at the beginning of the lecture. I don't know. I'm not a sociologist. But neglect and ignorance would appear to be problems if one wants to encourage participation and engagement. There is an additional problem, though. Could it be that a certain sort of political literacy might be worse than useless, perhaps even a dangerous thing? Noam Chomsky once observed that opposition to the Vietnam War did not begin with the middle classes and student demonstrations. Indeed, he said, the intelligentsia was the last group to come out against the war, even though intellectuals knew more about it. This is plausible. One requires a certain degree of political understanding to be able to see the benefits or desirability of bombing Cambodia in order to defeat the Viet Cong. One needs to have a little information in order to come to such disastrous conclusions. A naive political illiterate might not have the strategic knowledge required to see the point. Now, we're in Gramscian territory here, of course, intellectuals in the vanguard of political reaction. So the acquisition of greater political literacy on the part of an already educated class might not work. It might, from Marx, just facilitate the spread of ruling ideas. It might, from Gramsci, simply secure the hegemony of particular class interests. Think about the way in which, in international diplomacy, the weak political literacy of the liberal left has hitched itself to humanitarian intervention or responsibility to protect or human rights, each in their own way very capable, though not always, of solidifying and consolidating the structures of power which leave large parts of the world impoverished. We've all experienced at dinner parties or in lecture halls the confidence of the weakly literate. It's a very masculine phenomenon, if I can say that. It encompasses a sort of throat-clearing pomposity that one associates, say, with middle-level politicians or not-so-good political journalists. There's no way of breaking in because it all sounds so convincing and yet formulaic and vacuous at the same time. I'm not being facetious when I say there's something almost admirable about the sheer stamina and lack of irony or self-consciousness or doubt that goes into this sort of thing. Of course, it deadens the senses. And it's not as if I haven't caught myself opening my own mouth in this mode. I think we're missing an important, perhaps central point here, I find myself saying occasionally. What is striking is the absence of politics in many of these interventions and speeches. Eventually, there's just no sense of contestation or debate at all. The sense that principles might be at stake might even tragically conflict with each other. To restate the point then, it might be that political life in a way now demands the absence of politics. What of course is striking in addition about some genres of political illiteracy or weak literacy is the absence of history. So to go back to the beginning of the lecture, I spoke of these three monstrous disorders. But discussion of them can seem abstract or skewed. The financial crisis might close a few banks and require a bit of belt tightening. Rising sea temperatures might mean a change in beachside zoning regulations. But the possible effects of depression or ecological disaster are rarely spelt out. It seems likely that there might be a correlation, at least, between mass violence and insecurity and economic depression. Or that certain sorts of economic environmental transformation might radically deplete our political reserves and democratic processes. Yet, not much of this is subject of consideration. And anyway, the costs will be borne by others. I've seen equivalents in some military strategy circles where I have had people patiently describe to me how policy in Iraq was transformed by the insight that counterinsurgency was contextual, that it could only work if the local population could be persuaded that it was worthwhile, that it required a winning of hearts and minds. I wonder what was happening before these insights became widely accepted. Were 3 years really lost in Iraq before this realization crept back? This all recalls the think tanks of American mainstream intellectuals convened in the 1960s to come to what the Scottish novelist James Kelman described as, and I quote, the startling conclusion that you cannot isolate counterinsurgency problems from the people. That was 1966. Given all this, is there an explanation for the absence of political literacy? Or is it just a refusal to learn lessons? Does this somehow mark the end of argument? And again, we'll hear more about that next week, or the end of history? There are several possibilities as I wind up. I'll offer four very briefly, and these might well intersect, as I say, with the things that Rob Mann might say in a couple of weeks, or next week. First, it might be that a debased form of economic literacy has overtaken human sympathy, historical knowledge, and political dignity. This is a sort of economics detached from the conditions of life. I'm going to sound like a not in my backyard type here, but think about the way in which the plan for the East-West freeway through Fitzroy took shape. John Brumby, the then premier, flew in a helicopter above Melbourne and noticed that there was a bit of Melbourne not served by a very large freeway. This bit of Melbourne contains some of its most vibrant nightlife, cafes, bookshops, etc. But Brumby couldn't see that from the helicopter. And in a way, an economics of road building rarely does see the ground from where it soars. And this may be true of certain forms of economics in general. And no one can have missed the fact that in Australia in particular, politics has become the art of increasing material wealth. Kindness, decency, dignity, and so on seem to have gone missing in action. Don Watson, a master anthropologist of illiteracy in its many forms, noticed a few years ago that one of the Australian speakers at the Gallipoli service had spoken of the sacrifices many soldiers had made in 1917 for our lifestyles. And again, I think we all have a duty to take economics back from economists or financial wizards. When the Queen visited LSE recently to open the new academic building shared between lawyers and economists, she asked one of the economists how it all went wrong. Well, one start would be to go back to the basics and try to get some handle on the numbers. At the moment, political illiteracy takes the form of worrying about tiny amounts of bureaucratic waste or government red tape while engaging in trillion-dollar wars, or not making a link between the Stern Report's plea that we need $600 billion to save the planet and the expenditure of $600 billion on the banking bailout by one country, or failing to see that a generous aid package, say, the $10 million promised to Haiti by Stephen Smith in January 2010 following the earthquake, is the equivalent in value of three houses in North Fitzroy. Are we being mystified somehow by the numbers? So that's one possibility. A second possibility is that political life has been captured by a technocratic elite or expert class or career politician who doesn't really believe in politics anymore. And I've said something about this career politician already. There's always been a fear amongst elites that electorates will make the wrong choice. But this new anxiety after the Arab Spring and in Greece and Portugal has intensified the pressure on even the most attenuated forms of democracy that we have got used to. A third possibility is that politicians are worse than they were. I think this can't be quite true, or might be true and not true. But again, I do want to strike a note of caution. Disliking politicians is a deeply reactionary form of politics. It's a politics that's usually prepared to keep the fundamentals in place. At a business lunch recently in town, I heard an impassioned and eloquent speech from a gentleman sitting opposite me, directed at my half of the table. He had no time for Julia Gillard, Kevin Rudd, John Howard, Tony Blair. They were all responsible for the mess we were in. They had failed to take the long view. They had failed to understand the way the world worked. Around the table, heads nodded in furious agreement. Later, I asked him what he did. "I'm a banking executive," he replied, without a trace of self-consciousness. So hating politics or not being interested in politics is bovine and irresponsible. And anyway, politics is interested in us. And the worse things get, the more interested politics becomes. A fourth and final possibility is that we're being persuaded to think of fewer and fewer matters as political at all. Genuine political literacy would bring politics back in. Political apathy may be at an all-time high, but political activism is very high as well. Spending $80 a week on petrol, or sending one's children to private schools, or owning a holiday house, or flying frantically around the world is activism at its most active. Activities we think of as not political at all have become extraordinarily consequential. Yet we have devised or have been subjected to a set of, dare I say, ideological structures and conscious deadening languages that enable us to ignore the politics in these activities. A fierce commitment to personal choice or a belief in the sanctity of private space or a tolerance of democracy as simply the circulation of elites or a sort of ironic knowing gesturalism towards the sort of people who go on about petrol and holiday homes and private schools and ecological survival are the prevailing organizing modes of being and saying. They now seem inevitable and inescapable. So as I say, this is all a bit depressing. But I hope I offered some way of thinking about how political illiteracy might work and how we might think better about politics. I don't claim much success in these matters myself. The whole lecture can be read as a lengthy exercise in self-criticism. But I promised in the flyer a few words on political literateness. My advice here is to read more novels. But is there a politics of literature? There certainly has been a literature about politics and literature from the great moderns, Orwell and Eliot, through to Lionel Trilling, Raymond Williams, Terry Eagleton, Paul Fussell. And I think some caution is necessary here, too. It would be an obvious political and aesthetic disaster to demand of writers that they prescribe certain forms of governance or advance explicit political claims. We don't go to Nabokov for an assessment of the carbon tariff or ask what Henry James might have thought of states' rights. And the didactic novel doesn't work terribly well either. Character and plot come into the service of message in a way that doesn't usually succeed. There are always exceptions, of course, Kundera, Orwell again. And we certainly don't want to be governed by novelists and poets. Ezra Pound was a senator in Italy. His politics were largely repulsive. Norman Mailer stood for the mayor of New York City. He came fifth from four. Maria Vargas Llosa ran for the Peruvian presidency. But perhaps there are lessons to be learned about political literateness from reading. The great political novel of the century so far is, I think, Alan Hollinghurst's Line of Beauty. And I know Ray's heard me talk about this novel quite a bit. It somehow got me closer to Thatcherism than any of the biographies, including Hugo Young's superb account of her prime ministership. And this, I think, is important. Kate Grenville's Secret River, I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, too, struck me as an effectively imagined evocation of conquest, and one that maybe transcended debates about black armbands and genocide by showing at least one English settler as a victim who's also a victimizer. Perhaps people really can be brave and facilitate practices that come to be regarded correctly as abhorrent and perhaps genocidal. When I think of the familiar political novels of the 20th century, The Golden Notebook, The Handmaid's Tale, Darkness at Noon, Catch-22, Stefan Zweig, Heart of Darkness, The Emigrants, White Noise, I think of the way they offer a different sort of politics, one that is attentive to what might otherwise be lost or missing, what might be jarring or disjunctive, what might be ambiguous or difficult, what we might find hard to confront in ourselves and others. If politics has become a demand for certainty in radically uncertain times, think here of the rise of the conviction politician, someone unapologetically prepared to get it very wrong over and over again, then this sort of literature often seems to dislodge these certainties. These are hard times for political literacy and political dignity. What happened to politics? Well, one answer to conclude is that it became something else. Spin, consensus, private choice, inevitability, economic efficiency, development. Anything but itself. Anything but what it is. The hard work of trying to live together. And the hard work of speaking intelligibly and creatively to each other about the ways in which the goods in our commonly held world are to be allocated and distributed in a manner that might be plausibly defended as fair and just. Thank you.
Okay, Gary will take questions. Yes.
What I want to ask you is about the common thing, especially when it came to the refugee issue, when I discuss with certain people, they'll often say that, you know, politicians have to reflect the views of the electorate rather than be true leaders. And I feel that's complete, it's ironic. They're called leaders, and yet if the view is one thing but it should be raised to something better, they're not leading by not reflecting those views. How would you advise a politician who said the same thing, you know, I'm only reflecting the views of the electorate, to get them out of that?
I don't know, and I suspect that will be the answer I give for most of these questions. I mean, one could, of course, look at other places. I visited Turkey last year, and the problem of refugees and immigration in general is just much greater in Turkey. And yet, there isn't the same virulence about refugees there. I don't know what we can learn from the Turkish political system, but we might want to learn something at least. You've answered your own question, but politicians, it goes without saying, have to lead in these sorts of matters. And I happen to think when it comes to the refugee issue, the views of the electorate, whatever those views are, it's actually rather difficult to discover what the precise views of the electorate is on these questions anyway. But the views of the electorate, I think, can be relatively easily shaped in a way that promotes greater decency towards people who come to these shores. I think this is one of these issues where the political class and the political elites and the newspapers can actually lead, though whether the circumstances will allow that today, I don't know.
Sandhya?
Mm-mm. Now, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thanks, Gary, for a wonderful lecture. At a certain point, you said any discussion of political literacy or dignity. And I just wondered what you might say the relationship might be between political literacy and dignity. Or maybe I should be asking Ray that question.
Perhaps you should ask Ray that question over dinner tonight. I don't really have an answer to that because I didn't give a lecture on political dignity. I suppose this is offered as a bit of a gloss on the subject of political dignity. It's about how to talk about politics. One way to describe the difference between the two ideas is that political dignity is about partly the substance of what sort of politics and ethics we might want in our democratic order. The idea of political literacy is about how we might talk about these desires and projects and policies. And I have always thought that how we talk is very instrumental and sometimes decisive in the way we actually pursue the particular policies we pursue. And the general message of at least the early part of the lecture is that language matters a great deal in this. It shapes the conditions for policies and projects related to political dignity might be a somewhat banal answer to your question. Yes.
May I just say that your lecture deeply resonated with me, and particularly your starting point for becoming political about what you read. I was wondering if you could add to that with about what you watch, what films you watch.
You want a reading list?
Not as a reading list, but you spoke about the power of what you read is a starting point. So what you watch, given that we're a very visual society, to go and watch a film.
Yeah, look, what I would recommend is that you read Jonathan Franzen's essay, How to Be Alone, essays in How to Be Alone, which is about the problem of reading at all in this particular age. And again, this will resonate with my daughters, because I'm always railing against modern technologies. And this is a very visual culture we're in. I feel, Jonathan Franzen says at one point, every time a reader is born, every time a watcher is born, a reader dies. So that's the way the culture is developing. It's becoming, in fact, arguably less literate. They all sound very old-fashioned, almost Edwardian in saying that, because I imagine the next generation, wherever they are out there, will say, actually, there are many different ways to be literate. Though I spoke somewhat facetiously about the person that came to visit us, we learned a great deal from this person because she was literate in different ways. She was literate in the visual arts, she was literate in the fine arts, she was literate in modern art in ways that I'm not. So, you know, I'm not sure if I would necessarily simply argue for more reading, though that is my inclination. You know, that's the argument I really want to make, but I'm being polite because there are other cultural forms out there that deserve to be given respect and standing as well. But I'm the last person you should come to for, you know, a list of films you should watch, because I'll start with either Dr. Zhivago or something ridiculous like that. And I gave a list of books that I think would be usefully described as political books. It's a fairly standard list. There's nothing particularly clever about the list, but these books were very, very influential on me, and I think they were influential on many people. Franzen again says that Catch-22 was really the last big political book that made it commercially and had a huge impact on the culture. And of course, what motivated him was a desire to write another book like Catch-22. Now, whether he got there with the corrections or not, I don't know. But it's awfully hard for a novelist to make it these days at that level of cultural intensity and fame. He points to a list of 30 great cultural figures in the United States and noticed that only two of them were novelists and felt depressed by that. And I think that indicates that we are moving into what you might call a post-literate age. Now, I just don't know what the general effect on our politics will be. It looks as if the effects will be deleterious to me. But again, you know, one could be optimistic and say that even if Gina Reinhart does gain control of the age, and of course, many of us are deeply worried about this, but I think an obvious response would be to say, well, actually, the age doesn't really matter anymore. It doesn't form opinion in the way it might have done 20 years ago or 40 years ago. That there are many ways to get knowledge now that don't involve buying a newspaper and reading it in the Seven Seas. I don't know what those forms are, but I look forward to hearing about them.
Okay, so there's nobody over there. Yes.
Thanks. Thanks, Gary, very much for a fantastic and engaging lecture. I love the way you plotted the problem of politics and its evacuation from itself. So you said that politics has turned into a sort of pre-politics and a post-politics, but the guts of politics is not there anymore. And you mentioned also the sort of rise of technological, technocratic or economic forms of thought, you know, amongst others in its place. I'm really interested in that, as I'm sure lots of others are as well, and that's been a big theme in the 20th century, in fact, the end of political thought and the rise of economic thought to take its place. If politics is the sphere of contestation and conflict, and economics is meant at least to smooth out those kinds of conflicts and give us something we can all agree on, is there a possibility, do you see any possibility for recontesting economics, not by posing a different form of thought against it, but different forms of economics? Of course, there are many forms of economics, and we all know from our everyday lives that economics is not a sphere of consensus. We might have some nice theories about what people all want, but economics as it's done is not a sphere of consensus at all. I'm wondering what you think are the possibilities for conflict and economics to come back together.
Well, I keep expecting this to happen. In the light of the various financial crises and trauma that we've been going through for the last 10 years, I keep expecting this moment when economics will become a sphere of serious contestation. You know, I read The Guardian, sometimes even online, and I do get a sense that there is contestation, but it doesn't really seem to reach the elites. It doesn't reach the regulatory sector, for example. We expect some stronger forms of regulation, perhaps, given the economic collapse, or a different way of distributing wealth. But none of this ever seems to filter up to the decision makers somehow. So I do get the sense that there is some contestation. I suspect that economists have a role in this, that we need to ask economists to be somehow bolder. And the best example I can give is from the perspective of lawyers. I mean, I think about the way in which law is presented as a relatively uncontested framework for deciding social and political issues. And I remember many of us anguished over our activism in relation to the Iraq war, because many of us wanted to say that the war was unlawful. We wanted to establish our expertise in an uncontested framework, because we didn't like the war, and we wanted to use our expert standing to argue against the war. But we had to claim that law was somehow uncontested in that case, that the legal language and legal texts were largely determinate. And that seemed to go against something we had been arguing as lawyers, as critical lawyers, for 10, 20 years, the idea that this is, in fact, a highly contested discipline which produces many different answers. That's what we believed as an intellectual project, but it jarred with or came up against our political project of arguing against the Iraq war. I don't know if economists have the same level of angst about these things. They may do, and they certainly should have. But yeah, good question and very kind words, Connell. Thanks.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking about that and writing a note. I forgot my role.
I echo the compliments of many people. That was a most thought-provoking set of ideas that you presented. Look, two questions, both of which are firmly in the I don't know category, but I'll ask them anyway, since I'm sure you know more about politics than I do. First of all, and they're related, the first is, was there ever a golden age of political literacy in human history, really? And secondly, do you think that politicians would prefer that we, the electorate, be more or less politically literate? And what would they do to promote their particular preference in either case?
They're really good questions. The second question, I'm tempted to say that the left, the old socialist left, wanted people to be politically literate and would prefer that they were politically literate and tried to encourage all sorts of political and other forms of literacy through workers' clubs and libraries and so on. That was a major, Richard Hoggart writes nicely about this in The Uses of Literacy. This was one of the great left projects, to take the workers seriously as literate agents of political change. So I think from that perspective, the answer would be yes. For the politically conservative or reactionary politician, I don't know. My impression from having watched the Republican Party debates is that the level of political literacy on display was extremely low. I used Herman Cain as an example, perhaps unfairly, but his answers to questions during those debates was at an appallingly low level of political and other literacy. And I compared Tony Abbott extremely favorably to him, because Abbott is clearly a skillful politician compared to someone like that. So I can't imagine someone like that being comfortable with a politically literate electorate. Now, the golden age of political literacy, I don't know. Ray may have something to say about Socrates here, the Romans. Certainly two periods strike me as promising. One would be 1945 to 1950, when there were fairly high levels of political literacy in at least some Western democracies, and decent welfare states were constructed, the National Health Service, the Beveridge Report, the reform of education in the United Kingdom, and so on. I think people really had a sense that the grand strategy could be pursued and that people could understand what the meaning of that strategy might be and why they might have to pay for it, and thought about living in a particular political culture collectively and communally. The other politically literate period might have been a period in the 19th century when politicians and novelists seemed to be reading each other's work a great deal. So apparently Trollope and Disraeli, for example, read each other's work. Disraeli, of course, was a novelist and you know, a relatively good novelist by the standards of politicians who write novels now. Douglas Hurd, an English politician, writes novels, and Edwina Currie. It's a particular type of Tory politician that seems to write a fairly racy thriller that I wouldn't describe as demonstrating high levels of literacy. But that 19th century period, the Trollope Disraeli period, might be another example of a period marked by relatively high levels of political literacy. But who knows? I mean, it was a very small class, and I might just be engaging in nostalgia for the 19th century, a century I didn't live in.
Well, it seems to me, if art, actually thinking of your question, is to inform politics, it must be through what it enables us to say. And what we're able to say is in part a function of our literacy. Especially if it's true, and especially if it's also true, and I think it is true, in fact, I think it's one of the truisms of what was called the linguistic turn, when people realized to what degree what we can think depends on what we can say and how we say it. That our grasp on the concepts that inform the dignity of our politics, Sonia, is in large part a function of what Gary's calling our political literacy. I think you've just heard, you've heard a really brilliant lecture that in fact displayed all the attributes to which I mentioned at the beginning when I introduced Gary, except that I didn't then, in fact, speak about his eloquence. And it's not the kind of eloquence that Blair was aspiring to. and it's interesting to mark the difference. And when I think of the difference, I often think of Hannah Arendt's book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, in which she reports that Eichmann was infatuated by what he called the winged words of oratory. So much so that when he was asked to give a speech at his own execution, Arendt says that he seemed to forget that it was he who was being executed. so intoxicated was he by a funeral oration that he was giving. And she then discusses a lot the kind of thoughtlessness that is both the cause and effect of that kind of oratory, and it's exactly a different kind of eloquence that Gerry demonstrated, one not that not only expresses very serious thought, but makes a demand on those who are listening to the same kind of thought. And for that, I want to thank you very much.